authorize.
Okay, please have a seat. And good morning, everyone. We are on record in KIC versus Holland and Knight and Walter Featherly, 2BA 2159 Civil. And it looks like the same parties we had yesterday we have today. So good morning. And then there was a motion filed to reconsider by Mr. Earnhardt, and have you all received a copy of that?
We have, Your Honor.
Okay. So, Mr. Earnhardt, if you'd like to be heard, you can step up to the podium.
I don't know if there's much more to say, Your Honor, but we have a situation here. It wasn't of the defense's creation. It wasn't of Mr. Featherly's creation. But coming through the affidavits, we had a sudden change in the indemnity posture with the reservation of rights. Now, under the statute, that entitles Mr. Featherly to his own counsel to participate in all aspects of the litigation. And that's something I couldn't find a firm definition out there. And my personal experience is judges have dealt with it in various ways, although most of the cases where you have independent counsel, those cases settle. I mean, it just from 98%, it goes up to 99%. But the important thing here is liability has been imposed in this case based on a Rule 37 motion, of which, and the judge's orders, your orders are very clear, it's Holland and Knight couldn't find documents, and Holland and Knight was ordered. And then the answer was stricken, which struck the answer and the jury demand by Mr. Featherly. Even though he had the same counsel at the same time, his interests are not fully and totally aligned, as well as there's an important interest there. As the Alaska Supreme Court has said through the rules, the right to a jury is not something that can be waived lightly. It has to be a clear waiver, which did not occur in this case. With all that, I think it's important to either continue this hearing or somehow bifurcate Mr. Featherly out of it.
Okay. And I do want to hear, well, I want to see if either side would like time. I can't grant a motion to reconsider until I hear from parties. But just, I have a couple of questions for you, Mr. Earnhardt. So I took the liberty of looking at the court's prior orders, the two motions to compel that I granted and the motion to strike. And on page one of each of those orders, H&K is identified as being H&K and Walter Featherly.
But when you get to the actual what is being requested, what is being sanctioned, and what the sanction is, I mean, it seemed clear as I was reading it that H&K is referring to Holland and Knight. And in any case, I don't think there has been anything, and I won't pretend to be thoroughly versed in all of the briefing, but that Mr. Featherly withheld a document, couldn't find a document or anything else. This is all about, strictly about the business records of the law firm and not about Mr. Featherly's personal notes or anything else.
And to the extent that there's a challenge to the court's motion to strike or the prior motions to compel, we are way past the timeline for that. The orders for those were from 2024, April, from July, 2025. Those are the motions to compel. And then the court's order motion on the motion to strike was from November of last year. So any motion to reconsider would be way late procedurally. But you did raise a statute, 2196-100, which is the independent counsel statute. And I looked, I didn't see that referenced in either your motion to compel or the motion, the reply that you filed. So I'm not sure how the court overlooks that statute that wasn't referenced.
It was not referenced in the other motions, and at the time we were filing that, the main focus was strictly continuing this. But then yesterday raised the issue of participation in the litigation. But either way, the independent counsel, it wasn't referenced directly, but the whole fact that I was in there as conflict counsel, as appointed by the insurer, was, I believe, out and before you. We are in, no doubt, this is a messy conundrum, whatever, one of these situations. I understand where the court's coming from, and I really think it would be great to get this done by July. It's been around quite a while, but not as long as it's a number of cases. But at the same time, doing it right and not having it come back to some new judge to start all over again with a trial is also a goal. And one of those important issues hanging out there is Mr. Featherly's participation and his subject to the sanction.
Sure. Thank you. So does either side want to have time to respond to the motion to reconsider, or Mr. Hollander?
We are prepared to respond orally.
Sure. Come on up to the podium, please.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll ask Mr. McGuire if you want to respond.
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor,
before you talk, I was going to give you time if you wanted time, but if you don't want time, I'll hear from you right now.
We're prepared to respond now. I will say, obviously, we just got the motion in, but have had some time to review it and believe it's easiest just to deal with this promptly this morning. I have a few points to make. One is that Mr. Featherly is still represented. Mr. Featherly is represented by the same lawyers who have been representing him all along. Mr. Earnhardt cited to a case in his brief this morning, the CHI of Alaska, the employer's reinsurance case. And one thing that is specifically discussed in that case was a proposal that a conflict be resolved by having separate counsel only for a particular portion where there was some coverage dispute, a particular portion of a claim where there was some coverage dispute. And the court in that case, Supreme Court of Alaska, concluded that the two-counsel solution does not satisfactorily resolve the conflicts which have given rise to the right to independent counsel. In other words, if we had a motion here, if either Mr. Featherly was seeking to relieve the lawyers who have been representing him for years now, or if they were seeking to withdraw on the basis of some conflict, that might be a different situation. But it's not. No one is depriving Mr. Featherly of his right to participate in these proceedings or to defend against these proceedings. And frankly, no one is stopping Mr. Earnhardt from participating in these proceedings. It's maybe a better question for defense counsel, but I assume that if there were some division of time and Mr. Earnhardt, was given some amount of time to answer questions or give a presentation here in court, that would be acceptable. A few other points. A lot of this goes to Mr. Patuminis' affidavit, where he discusses what he views as the potentially criminal nature of the strict foreclosure scheme. Nowhere in Mr. Patuminis' affidavit does he say that Mr. Featherly himself is criminally liable. He simply discusses his role as an attorney in advising about a scheme that he now opines, based on the record before him, may violate various criminal statutes. Third, I would address the time to reconsider. Again, the basis, as we just heard from Mr. Earnhardt, for these arguments is that he does not feel Mr. Featherly should have been included in the discovery sanctions that were imposed on the defendants. Those, as Your Honor pointed out, were months ago. The time to address those sanctions has long passed. But I will say that we raised at the time, and we have raised throughout this case, that the discovery responses from the defendants included both Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly. In fact, it was defendants who, in initial responses to our discovery requests, defined H&K to mean Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly. I would have to go back and look through the record, but it seems like that is perhaps why in numerous documents there's references only to H&K and not to Mr. Featherly, because defendants themselves expressly defined H&K to include Mr. Featherly. There was also no question of whose discovery obligations they were. They were all of the defendants. Documents that should have been produced and sources from which documents should have been collected but were not included Mr. Featherly's personal drives. It was only after multiple discovery sanctions that the defendant said, well, we've gotten portable drives from Mr. Featherly, and we are collecting documents from them, and we'll produce, you know, anything. And there were a couple of documents produced from those drives. So the idea that it was solely Holland and Knight's misconduct and not Mr. Featherly's is just not correct. There was also no forced waiver of a jury trial. It was waived. It was not requested. And I have here Mr. Featherly's deposition transcript, where Mr. Slarsky asked him right at the beginning. And this is on page eight of the deposition transcript. Mr. Slarsky asked him, you understand that the court and this video or this transcript is used by a jury, they're going to assume that you understand the questions I asked, et cetera. And he says, you understand that your testimony could be played for a jury, right? Mr. Featherly himself at that point says, well, I do not know whether a jury has been demanded in this case. Mr. Slarsky asks, and it could be played in front of a jury, correct? And Mr. Featherly says, well, if there were a jury in this case, yes. This is not an issue that is new to Mr. Featherly specifically. He was well aware of his right to demand a jury that was waived. And one other point that I will address in Mr. Earnhardt's brief, he echoes what I believe he said yesterday regarding the 8A issue, what I'll call the 8A issues that I gave the court a presentation on yesterday. I'm not sure, frankly, what courtroom Mr. Earnhardt was in, but Mr. Featherly's conduct and role was implicated throughout that presentation. So the suggestion that there is some issue because other lawyers also may have played a role or interacted more directly with Melanie Roller, for instance, is simply a red herring. Mr. Featherly's role in all of those actions was critical and central to it. So, with that, Your Honor, we would ask that the motion to reconsider be denied.
So the motions to reconsider are based on the court overlooking something. You've addressed something from quite a while ago, which I think just procedurally is not something I would consider. So do you want to talk about the statute that he mentions?
Your Honor, I have not had a chance to examine the statute. I will echo something that was in Your Honor's question, which was, these arguments were not raised in the underlying motion for a continuance. How can it be that reconsideration is appropriate when there are new arguments or new facts, not new facts in the world, but new facts being injected into the motion to reconsider that were not raised, that were not before the court when it was asked to consider the motion for a continuance? So we would submit, in addition to everything that I said just now, that there is no legal basis for reconsideration at this moment in terms of new law or new facts or law that the court overlooked when it was originally presented with the motion to continue.
So let me just clarify and make sure I'm hearing what you're saying. Are you just repeating the court's refrain, or are you, after looking at the motion practice and the reply, you believe that the court did not overlook 2196-100?
That is correct, Your Honor, the latter.
Okay. Mr. Earnhardt, you want to be heard on a reply?
I will keep it brief. As I said, the hard part here is just getting up fully to speed, and that's where Mr. Featherly loses out on his rights. And 2196-100 was implicitly discussed as far as independent counsel, but it does create that right to fully participate, and I think that would include preparation. And, this is serious issues of due process. The one thing I will directly respond to is, and there was a lot of this yesterday, one, I think on the 8A presentation, it was very much, Mr. Featherly said our firm does 8A at the beginning. But on what was the problems with that, where that was bad advice, was all talking about other Holland and Knight attorneys and not Mr. Featherly actually providing direct 8A advice. And that is problematic for the court. I would assume if we're drafting some sort of damages order and judgment, against individual defendants as opposed to saying that they're collectively the same. The other thing is
let me ask you a question there. It's kind of related to the motion to reconsider, but it's about the court's consideration of damages. Are you saying that the court should apportion and not find joint something different than joint and several?
Well, it's as long as Mr. Featherly is in there individually, if we're not saying everything he did is in the course and scope, I think the court almost has to apportion of what was Mr. Featherly participate in these things, and they may, in fact, are very well within the course and scope, but as far as damages on one other issue or several other issues, if he wasn't participating, he shouldn't be subject to a judgment individually against him. I don't know of a ruling in this case. I didn't see anything that would say it, that somehow that this is strictly joint and several without that ruling that everything is within the course and scope. And the last thing I want to say is, you know, it was said, well, Mr. Featherly in his deposition said he didn't know if there was a jury demand, if there was a jury demand. He didn't say whether there was one or whether he knew whether there was one or whether he considered whether there was one. He said, I don't know. It'll play in front of a jury if there's a jury. And in regard to the Chai case, my memory of that case is the Supreme Court was just not happy with the idea of the insured would have to go hire their own counsel and pay for their own counsel. And they were trying to sort through a situation. And after the Chai case was finished, both Alaska in the new statute, which was originally 2189-100, but now 2196-100, and California, because the Cumulus case was what was the lead case on that, have been developing both their statutes and the law in that area of independent counsel.
Mr. McGuire, anything new that has come up that you want to respond to at all?
Your Honor, I'll just reiterate rely on the arguments I made with the original motion, but because the issue's on the table, I'll just flag for the court in Your Honor's ruling on the motion to continue. I think there was an error in indicating that both firms had been representing Mr. Featherly and Holiday Knight since the start of the case. I think you indicated in a couple of places that Cash and Gilmore and Davis Wright had been involved since the inception when Davis Wright appeared in the middle of August.
Towards the end. Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. Okay. Cashin and Gilmore want to be heard?
No, thank you, Your
Honor. Okay. All right. And good morning. Okay. Then I guess based on what I've heard this morning and based on the court's review of what was filed, it doesn't appear that the citation to 2196-100 was included in the motion to continue or the reply, so the court didn't overlook it. So it can't be a basis for granting a motion to reconsider. The other citations, or I guess the other bases, include the motion to compel, two of them, motion to strike. Those all were decided months ago, so a motion to continue, or sorry, a motion to reconsider based on those is not timely by a long stretch. However, Mr. Earnhardt is part of the case, so counsel will have to figure out how to integrate him, and you'll have to figure out what part you play in the damages portion, which is where we're at. And it's one of the challenges of coming late to a party. It's what's going on and who's here and how do I fit. But I'll leave it to you. You all know each other, I assume. So you'll have to figure out how to integrate. This morning is about UTPA. The afternoon is about punitive damages. And please let me know how you are going to resolve to integrate presentations. But are you asking to adjust any time right now, just so parties know? You each have an hour this morning, so.
Okay. Your Honor, I think Mr. Earnhardt's interested in maybe 5 or 10 minutes at the end of our section if needed.
Okay, sure. And just remind me, Mr. Earnhardt, please. Okay. Thank you. Okay, then let's get started. I see a new binder here, so we have an hour and let's see, 9:41.
Your Honor,
I just had a couple reply points to Mr. McGuire's presentation yesterday. Is it possible to make those in advance of the hour?
Double damages?
It was on double damages and a couple other issues.
Going to give you a half an hour sometime today.
That's perfect.
I don't think we need to come back tomorrow. I don't have anything else that I think we need to come back for. So today is going to be the final day for presentation, and then I'll set a hearing Friday. I'm a little jammed on Friday, so we'll have to figure that out. But I have a 9 that's going to go a little bit, and then I have 10:30 criminal court. We try to keep afternoons free for the court, but what I would propose is I think we're going to have to do 1 o'clock, even though I would try to stay away from that. So Friday, 1 o'clock, the court will announce compensatory damages and whether punitives applies or not.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah. And then just maybe it's after your reply today. You can have 20, 30 minutes, yeah.
Just to clarify the schedule, yeah. Sorry to belabor this. Friday, 1 o'clock, the court will indicate whether we'll have another punitive damages hearing.
Correct.
And if we do, it will be on Monday, or will it be?
Right. Well, we could look at a schedule then to see what's involved. I'll have more thinking done by then. Right.
Okay.
I think it makes sense to start the week. It's at 9 o'clock on Monday, and we'll go from there and see how it goes if we have it.
So. Okay. The reason I ask, Your Honor, is that we have some of the team are from the lower 48, and I'm wondering whether they go home or hang around.
I'll announce on Friday whether punitive damages, we'll have a proceeding on that.
Okay, and when?
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, but I mean, you told me what you told me, so I think Monday makes sense to do it then instead of Tuesday or Wednesday.
Okay.
But we have those 3 days, so, yeah. Okay. Mr. Hollander.
Good morning again, Your Honor. Here to discuss the question of damages under the UTPA. And specifically, Your Honor had requested a discussion of which of the different categories of damages discussed in Professor Colt's report implicate misconduct under the UTPA and ought to be trebled as a result. And although mostly this morning I intend to focus on evidence around each of those categories of damages, I thought it would be helpful to start with just a brief discussion of the types of conduct that constitute UTPA violations. The Alaska Supreme Court has addressed this multiple times.
Screen needs to be turned on.
Yeah, I believe we just need the screen turned on.
The channel changer?
Screen. Oh, that's. Found the remote easier than when it's in the couch cushions at home.
And if we could, that iPad, I noticed yesterday it's only capturing some of you, so it should at least get the speaker, so we could turn it to the right. Yep, that. To the right. Nope, that's, that way. And, yep, that looks great.
Maybe.
All right. Perfect. Thank you.
What types of conduct constitute UTPA violations? Well, in the State v. O'Neill investigations case, the court explained that there's 2 elements. 1, that the defendant is engaged in trade or commerce, and 2, that in the conduct of trade or commerce, an unfair act or practice has occurred. And the court clarified that an act or practice is deceptive or unfair if it has the capacity or the tendency to deceive. Now, in the Borgen v. A&M Motors case, the court explained that even truthful statements can be actionable under some circumstances because of the manner in which the facts are presented. And moreover, that unfair and deceptive are used in the disjunctive in Section 471A, that either will suffice to give rise to liability. In the Kenai Chrysler v. Denison case.
That's Kenai.
Kenai, I'm sorry. Us folks in the lower 48 are learning as we go.
Yeah.
in the Kenai Chrysler v. Dennison case, that it is enough to show that acts and practices were capable of being interpreted in a misleading way. The court's focus on the unfairness of the disputed practice of the specific circumstances presented, and also that an act or practice can be unfair and implicate liability under the statute without being deceptive. Because the UTPA is a remedial statute, its language should be liberally construed. Now, when we talk about what types of damages are cognizable under the UTPA, what types of what items may constitute an ascertainable loss, the portfolio recovery case is instructive there. Among other things, we see, first of all, that as a basis of proof, testimony given under the threat of perjury, whether by affidavit, deposition, or at trial, sufficiently demonstrates ascertainable loss under the statute. And when we look at the types of items that the court considered as ascertainable loss in that matter, they include there was an initiation of litigation wrongfully. In that matter, it was a debt collection case that was initiated without any factual basis. And the ascertainable losses to the defendant in that case included legal fees incurred when defending claims and pursuing counterclaims in response to the litigation that should never have been brought, but also even incidental claimed expenses, like the costs of parking when visiting the lawyer's office. Now, Your Honor has already considered the question of the application of the UTPA to attorney misconduct. The court has addressed this in numerous cases. I'm going to just look at a couple of them here. In the Pepper v. Routh Crabtree case, the court confirmed that the UTPA does not apply only when applied to lawyers to entrepreneurial activities, or when applied to the learned professions, I should say. It also includes activities that relate to the pure practice of law. It rejected the argument that attorney liability for UTPA liability would be inconsistent with an attorney's duty of undivided loyalty. And in the, and I will probably pronounce this wrong as well, but the Mertes and Mertes v. Leisnoy case, the court affirmed UTPA liability against attorneys where they were part and parcel of the deceptive and unfair acts. Now, as the court is probably aware, the Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices statute has a Part A and a Part B, and Part B lists out numerous examples of types of unfair and deceptive conduct, or unfair or deceptive conduct. It's not an exhaustive list of the types of wrongdoing that may implicate the UTPA, but certain of these items I wanted to focus on. Subsection 7, disparaging the services or business of another by false or misleading representation of fact. Subsection 11, engaging in any other conduct, creating a likelihood of confusion or misunderstanding that misleads, deceives, or damages a buyer or a competitor in connection with the sale or advertisement of goods or services. Subsection 12, using or employing deception, fraud, false pretense, false promise, misrepresentation, or knowingly concealing, suppressing, or omitting a material fact with the intent that others rely upon the concealment, suppression, or omission in connection with the sale or advertisement of goods or services, whether or not a person has in fact been misled, deceived, or damaged. And subsection 14, representing that an agreement confers or involves rights, remedies, or obligations that it does not confer or involve, or that are prohibited by law. Now, Category 1 of the damages that Professor Colt addresses in his report and affidavit are the loss of Marsh Creek enterprise value. I thought it would be helpful first to look again at Mr. Lampe's affidavit and see what Mr. Lampe had to say about his and KIC's interactions with Mr. Featherly and Holland and Knight. Paragraph 6, Mr. Lampe explains that the defendants did not advise KIC how to negotiate a fair transaction. Instead, the defendants, and Mr. Featherly in particular, recommended that KIC offer a very low purchase price based on what we later learned was the defendant's own arbitrary view of what the purchase price should be, which was inconsistent with the valuation provided by a licensed appraiser. Paragraph 7, that the defendants advised KIC improperly to limit Solston's access to Marsh Creek's records and books and management with the objective of pressuring Solston to sell its interest to KIC at an unfairly low price, and that KIC followed that advice, not knowing it was a breach of duties to its partner. Paragraph 10, Mr. Lampe explains that based on the defendant's direction and advice, he understood the financing and foreclosure terms as part of the strict foreclosure that were prepared by Mr. Featherly and Holland and Knight were commercially reasonable, and that the recommended transactions were consistent with KIC's duties. In paragraph 31, Mr. Lampe explains that the former president of KIC, Matthew Rexford, was put, as he puts it, in an impossible position. Mr. Featherly manipulated him and used him to communicate with the rest of the board, falsely convincing him, and he in turn convincing us, that Solston was the enemy, and KIC should trust Mr. Featherly and Holland and Knight to protect us from Solston. In paragraph 32, he explains that when the defendant's plan collapsed, Mr. Featherly let Matthew Rexford think it was his fault. And in paragraph 33, Mr. Lampe explains that we hired Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly because they were supposed to be the experts. We trusted them completely. They reassured us that everything would be fine and that they had our best interests at heart, but as we have come to learn, they lied to us. They knew or disregarded clear indicators that the strategies they were pursuing would not work. They did not disclose that these strategies contained significant risks. Mr. Featherly and his firm took advantage of our trust and our lack of legal and business expertise, plotting a course that we now understand they knew was destined for failure. I'd also like to look at what Mr. Petuminis had to say. And Mr. Petuminis, although his opinions go more directly to malpractice issues, addresses the unfair, deceptive, misleading nature of much of Holland and Knight's conduct. He writes that the cautionary information and research that Holland and Knight lawyers themselves received internally about the scheme appears never to have been forwarded to its client, KIC. That there were items that the KIC board of directors could not have been assumed to properly analyze, absent a careful, detailed analysis and fully developed legal analysis. Mr. Petuminis explains that given the illegality of the course of conduct taken, had it been completely undertaken and faithfully reported, the course of conduct would not have been pursued at all, and that this was more than oversight on the part of Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly. Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly were in possession of legal writings and research that they had specifically solicited internally. Yet, Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly did not provide their client with a single written explanation, a single writing explaining and setting forth with particularity what they themselves knew were the risks that the course of action Holland and Knight advocated for presented. And Mr. Tuminis goes on that another course of conduct constituting legal malpractice stems from Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly's venture into areas for which they lacked expertise, experience, and for which they were not retained. Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly took it upon themselves to construct, design, and carry out the strict foreclosure plan. Neither Mr. Featherly nor any attorney assigned to this matter held the expertise to create and choose among available business plans. construct and carry out the plan, or evaluate the options to assist their client in seeing their way through the business problem presented, and that the undertaking of business planning and upper-level management functions of KIC, which were neither within the scope of their retention to provide legal advice, and for which Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly lacked the expertise and competence to provide, violated, was an act of legal malpractice and violated the Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct. Now, the defendant's strategy and actions were expressly designed to deprive Sulston of fair value. If we go to KIC 41, which we looked at yesterday, we see that the strict foreclosure scheme that contributed to the loss of enterprise value and creating the new KIC subsidiaries was designed to eliminate Sulston's leverage. We saw that document yesterday. I'm not sure if it's in binders again today.
41 is not.
Okay. And 68, that securing the loan with Marsh Creek's assets, part of the basis was that it would prove helpful with the Sulston issue. Now, the defendants introduced KIC to Mr. Von Bergen. They had KIC retain Mr. Von Bergen as the M&A expert who would shepherd the M&A deal consistent with the mandate. Yet Mr. Von Bergen was almost immediately sidelined, played no meaningful role. Mr. Featherly drove the process, although he admittedly lacked M&A expertise. And we can go back to the page from Mr. Featherly's deposition transcript. It shows pages 126 and 128 of his deposition, when he confirmed that he did not have that expertise. You're not an M&A lawyer. No, I'm not. And then on the following, on page 128, you don't have any specific certifications in business valuation, right? I did not. Correct. Mr. Bergen, who did, was sidelined. That was false and misleading conduct. Now, if we go to KIC 17, in the excerpts in the binders, we see regarding the valuations that defendants kept Mr. Gebhardt's valuation from Sulston. Again.
Say that again.
That the defendants at Holland and Knight kept Mr. Gebhardt's valuation work from Sulston. We also know, and we see this in KIC 12, that defendants went to BDO. They asked for assistance. BDO expressly said, here is some analysis. This is not a valuation. It can't be relied on, and it would be misleading to use BDO's name. And defendants turned around, and as we see here in Exhibit 12, gave the analysis to Sulston as BDO's work to dispute the valuation. In KIC 33, we see how Ms. Curtis, after getting a draft valuation from the appraiser, didn't say, we should disclose this, or this is the valuation from the appraiser. She said, this is a draft valuation, so we can revisit some items. If we go to Mr. Stein's report, he explains many of the issues in the valuations or around the valuations that constituted false or deceptive conduct by defendants. As Mr. Stein explains, okay, and I'm sorry, I understand we don't have the slides, but I will read a few items from Mr. Stein's report that I know the court has. Holland and Knight substituted its own valuation model for the professionally obtained appraisals, it does not appear that Holland & Knight fully advised KIC of its pricing methodology or warned KIC of the risks of such tactics, that Holland & Knight failed to disclose material information to Solston, which would enable it to make an informed decision relating to the price and terms, that Holland & Knight's approach to information sharing and disclosure unduly constrained Solston's ability to evaluate and negotiate, that Holland & Knight excessively interfered in pricing and valuation, including preparing its own appraisal model, which it offered in place of the professional appraisals, and that Holland & Knight took over the communication and negotiation process and failed to provide Solston with material information as well. And we also know and saw evidence yesterday that the defendants unfairly denied Solston access to information and to the management of Marsh Creek on false pretenses. If we go to KIC 47, we see misrepresentations from Mr. Featherly regarding Ico Bay, which was then used as an excuse, a false pretense, to prevent Solston from contacting Marsh Creek management or participating in Marsh Creek Management Committee meetings. Mr. Featherly writes that Solston has acknowledged and admitted that it was responsible for the deficiencies at Ico Bay. And that never happened, Your Honor. Mr. Featherly also writes that the Bureau of Land Management directed Marsh Creek to terminate Solston's subcontract. And there's no evidence of that in the record, Your Honor. If we go to KIC 54, we see evidence of defendants' repeated, unexplained, and unnecessary delays and refusals to provide financial information to Solston. Solston's attorney, Natalie Kale. And KIC 54 is one of the letters from Ms. Kale, discusses her frustrations and Solston's inability to access information or hold Marsh Creek Management Committee meetings. She expresses these concerns, and Mr. Featherly's response is, I guess, respond rescheduling the next Marsh Creek meeting and ignore the rest. Ignore the rest. Unfair or deceptive. We go to KIC 48. We see Mr. Featherly canceling a Marsh Creek Management Committee meeting that was supposed to be the next day, right after Solston suggested a collaborative effort to effectively present a 2018 response to the Bureau of Land Management. In other words, instead of working with their partner as requested and having the meeting that was scheduled to address issues affecting Marsh Creek, Mr. Featherly cancels the meeting. And KIC...
Let me ask you, Mr. Holland, yes. Let me ask you, so one of the emails or letters that I saw from Ms. Kale to Mr. Featherly described that, or she summarized 3 years' worth of management meetings as being only one per year. What was the net effect? Like, I think it was for 15, 16, 17, or 14, 15, 16. What was the net effect of that based on your review of the record as to the business Marsh Creek?
Sure. So I think it's helpful to understand that period of time, and that's a period of time that the defendants point to where Marsh Creek's financial condition gets worse year over year. And the defendants want to say, well, this is evidence that Marsh Creek was bound to fail. And that's just simply not the case. What is going on during that time is it is clear that Marsh Creek's financial condition is getting worse. It is clear that there are management issues and operational issues that ought to be addressed, that need to be addressed. Solston, which is very experienced and has substantial expertise in the areas that Marsh Creek was working on, is trying to access Marsh Creek's management. They're trying to access financial information, and they're trying to find out what is going on so that maybe we can help, right the ship at Marsh Creek. Maybe there's changes in some of Marsh Creek's management that need to be made. Maybe there's different strategic decisions that need to be made. The defendants characterize this as Sulston and Mr. Dudley trying to take over Marsh Creek, trying to improperly usurp the folks who were running Marsh Creek, and that because KIC is the 51% owner, that means KIC is entirely justified in shutting Sulston out, not just from actually making decisions, but from having access to information and management.
No, I understand the dynamic. What I'm looking for is the net effect.
Well, the net effect is that Marsh Creek continues to decline in value, in revenues and ultimately in value substantially over that time.
Why?
Well, because management of Marsh Creek, and we don't have them here, but in the deposition transcripts of Marsh Creek's management, it is very hard to avoid the conclusion that the CEO, the CFO, the COO of Marsh Creek are not doing their job. They are taking direction ultimately from Holland and Knight. They're taking direction from KIC, which is taking direction from Holland and Knight. But among other things, the chief operating officer testified that he had never even read the operating agreement. The chief financial officer of Marsh Creek testified that even at the time of the strict foreclosure, he had not read the loan documents, and he did not understand that all of Marsh Creek's assets were at risk because all of Marsh Creek's assets secured these loans. They were simply asleep at the switch, and these were the issues that Sulston was trying to address, and that by not having access to Marsh Creek's management, not being able to participate enough in Marsh Creek Management Committee meetings, there was no opportunity to help address these serious issues that everyone acknowledges were going on at Marsh Creek.
Is there any place else that Marsh Creek is supposed to get direction other than the management meetings as far as their operations? I mean, they're a corporation unto themselves, right?
Right. Marsh Creek's, I want to just be clear, and I think Your Honor understands this, there's both Marsh Creek's management, its CEO, CFO, et cetera, and then there's the management committee, which has representatives from both KIC and Sulston. At the management committee meetings, the members, you know, ostensibly meet, review various items that are important, and then provide guidance and direction to the management of Marsh Creek. So ultimately, the oversight of Marsh Creek's management is the management committee. There is no other, you know, formal mechanism that is overseeing Marsh Creek's management. And what we saw time and again, and what we now have seen even more in hindsight, was that Marsh Creek's management was either not up to the task, not putting in any effort, or both.
Are there any examples in the record that prior to 2015, prior to, or 2014, I guess, prior to H&K coming on board, that the management meetings were successful in how Sulston and KIC interacted to provide guidance to Marsh Creek?
You know, as I stand here right now, I don't have specific examples. I would say the Gaypart appraisals discuss the productive, cooperative, successful relationship between Sulston and KIC in managing Marsh Creek over time. Right. In a sense, KIC's partner in management over time became Holland and Knight rather than Sulston, and Mr. Featherly rather than Sulston. But to more directly answer your question, the best evidence is probably Mr. Gaypart's discussion of the productive relationship that the two partners enjoyed. And we also see, in for instance, KIC 50, that KIC itself welcomed the participation of Sulston. We see Ms. Kale pushing back on Mr. Featherly, detailing the history of frustrations, but also noting that Mr. Rexford acknowledged the need for a manager's meeting and admitted that KIC was behind in scheduling one, and even proposed a date and time for such a meeting. Matthew Rexford, the president at the time of KIC and the member of the management committee, is saying, yes, we realize we need to meet. And it's then Mr. Featherly who comes in and is canceling meetings, like the meeting that was scheduled at this time in May of 2017. In KIC 54, I'm sorry, I will quickly go through a couple. This is fine. In KIC 54, we see the concern that Marsh Creek has not had a single manager's meeting in 2017, nor have any of the matters that are of concern to Sulston regarding Marsh Creek been addressed. There's only one management meeting was held in each of calendar years 2016 and 2015, despite significant efforts on Sulston's part. You can also look at KIC 42, which is the May 17th, 2017 email from Sarah Curtis instructing Matthew Rexford to cancel the next day's scheduled meeting. At KIC 46, which again discusses the frustration with the repeated inability to hold Marsh Creek Management Committee meetings.
If KIC is the 51% partner, any meeting that happens, any decisions are going to be controlled by KIC. So why not have a meeting? Why not talk about the business operations? What's the fear? What do you know from the record? What's the issue?
You know, the best that it seems from the record, I don't even want to really fairly call this evidence that was in the record, but I will say the nature of the arguments that the defendants have made and questions that they were asking throughout depositions was that Sulston was somehow acting inappropriately trying to take over Marsh Creek.
But they could never do that.
Correct.
I mean, is it fear of opinions?
It may be, Your Honor. It may have been some insecurity, some concern. It may have been part of what we saw yesterday discussed as Mr. Featherly's desire or intent to drive down the value of Marsh Creek over time in order to bring down what would ultimately be a purchase price of
sure.
Sulston's 49% interest.
That's a harder place to get to. I get the argument over time for that, but it just doesn't, you know, it's not apparent from the record why. Obviously, there's a very concerted effort to not have meetings, but it doesn't make sense from a business standpoint to not have meetings. If the concern from KIC through their lawyer is that, well, we don't want them to take over, well, they could never take over. So what's the fear? What are they afraid of?
Respectfully, Your Honor, that may be a better question for defense counsel. I think Sulston shared that question throughout the time. Because, of course, the defenses that were given, the arguments that were given at the time by Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly were, well, you know, you don't have a right to make decisions. And in the operating agreement and in other governance documents, decision-making authority is vested in, you know, ultimately in the management of Marsh Creek, in the CEO, CFO, et cetera, of Marsh Creek. Now, that's a non sequitur.
Right. Why be in a JV with another company?
Correct, Your Honor.
What's their role? And I'll be asking the same questions to Mr. McGuire. I mean, it's, we'll stay away from marriage, but you all have associates. They're not in charge, but you certainly have them to do work, and you want to hear if they've spent 20 hours, 30 hours, 40 hours looking at something. I would think you'd want to hear what they have to say, even though they're not in charge, right? I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's a head-scratcher, and it seems like Sulston, based on the record, you know, they have some business acumen, they have some sharp people, and it seems like if Marsh Creek wants to be successful, and they've been able to meet and talk before, why not keep talking? Make the point that KIC is in charge. I don't think Sulston doesn't know that. It's in writing. they could never take over. So I'm not sure what the...
Correct, Your Honor. If we had a better answer to that question, a lot of things may have gone differently over time.
Yeah.
There's no clear reason why Sulston should not have... why those meetings should not have occurred, why Sulston should not have had access to information and the management of Marsh Creek. And I think it's very likely, at the very least, it's very likely that had Sulston properly been able to access Marsh Creek's management and information about its financial condition, there would have been less ability for Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly to control the narrative of what was happening at Marsh Creek.
Yeah, that might be it. That might be it. We'll see.
In the interest of time, I can turn now to the next categories in Professor Colt's report.
Sure.
I'm going to discuss categories 2 and 3 together, which were category 2, the loss of cash contributed by KIC to Marsh Creek and Kaktovik Holdings, which was between $2.8 and $2.9 million, as well as roughly $500,000. That was the loss of the cash from the net proceeds from the sale of the 2000 East 88th building. And Professor Colt explains that these were contributions that prolonged the ultimate and, in light of the defendant's misconduct, inevitable demise of Marsh Creek and Kaktovik Holdings. These contributions, especially contributions to Kaktovik Holdings, were money that left KIC in support of the doomed effort to establish new 8A subsidiaries. These amounts that are listed out in Professor Colt's report include the loans from KIC to Marsh Creek that were part of the strict foreclosure scheme. They were directly tied to unfair and deceptive conduct by the defendants. Material details of the loans were concealed and misrepresented, and we'll see a bit more of this when discussing the arbitrator's award. The risks of the strategy, the strict foreclosure strategy, were concealed from KIC. I believe we're having some trouble with the slides, but I will direct you in the meantime to any exhibits as they come up.
Can you explain the, on page 6 from Mr. Colt's affidavit? He says the remaining 50% of Kaktovik Holdings' 51% ownership share related to the building was paid to KH and then ultimately lost.
Yes.
So what's the ultimately lost piece?
The ultimately lost, it's not... It doesn't mean, you know, misplaced, that the money went missing in some sense.
I get that.
Right. It was lost, for lack of a better term, we could call it, kind of a black hole or a vortex. Obviously, the money did not go into a black hole. It was spent through Kaktovik Holdings on the attempts to establish the new 8A subsidiaries in the 8A program, on funding operations of those operating subsidiaries, which, as we discussed yesterday at length, was a doomed effort from the start as fruit of the poisonous tree, because they were doomed by the financial misconduct at, that was part of the strict foreclosure scheme and the flow of assets and liabilities through that scheme into the new entities. So it was money that was put into Kaktovik Holdings in what the defendants knew was a doomed effort, and what Ms. Roller explained, had those red flags been aware to her, she would have advised them not to go forward with these new subsidiaries and try to work in the 8A program at all. In addition, just on the topic of unfair and deceptive conduct. Again, with Ms. Roller, the defendants brought in Ms. Roller to set up the new subsidiaries, and as she says, she was never given the highly relevant information constituting those red flags. Had she known, she would have advised them not to submit the applications. We can turn to categories 4 and 5 of Mr. Colt's report. These were attorney fees paid to Holland and Knight and attorney fees paid to Schwabe. Just first, very quickly, I want to note on the record that KIC agrees that there were a portion of the fees charged by Holland and Knight that were claimed as damages initially that were never paid.
True.
It's $271,000 and change. Given that Holland and Knight's counterclaim was struck when the court struck defendant's pleading, to the extent that amount is no longer claimed and owed, we would agree that that does not constitute damages and should not be included in a damages calculation. Reserving the right, certainly, to claim those damages if at some point that amount becomes claimed again by Holland and Knight and is due and owing. Now, the legal fees that were incurred due to unfair or deceptive misconduct were incurred as a result of unfair and deceptive conduct. The defendants misrepresented the M&A experience and expertise that they were bringing to bear. They misrepresented key, highly material information regarding the timeline for standing up new 8A entities. They directed a highly improper, illegal, potentially criminal scheme around the strict foreclosure. They caused KIC to initiate the arbitration against Solston on false pretenses. And KIC incurred legal fees to Holland and Knight and then Schwabe as a result. Now, the next category are the consulting fees paid to Richard Strutz and his entity, RCS Consulting, were billed by Mr. Strutz. Some were paid, some are still owing. First, to be clear, these are still damages to KIC. Mr. Strutz, as he testified in his deposition, expects to be paid, as opposed to, say, certain invoices from Schwabe that were resolved and are not claimed as damages. Mr. Strutz expects to be paid, and that's why these are still damages to KIC. Now, after the strict foreclosure scheme, the record shows that Mr. Featherly introduced Mr. Strutz to KIC. KIC retained Mr. Strutz to wind down its operations and liquidate assets. And these, again, were funds used in the futile attempts to stand up the new 8A subsidiaries, the funds that were generated from Mr. Strutz's work, liquidating assets and winding down operations. And that brings us to the last category that Mr. Colt discusses, which is the arbitration judgment, which with interest totals nearly $7 million. I want to first go back to the arbitration award at KIC 176. And we're still having problems, apparently. I'm told it's toast. So I apologize, Your Honor, but we'll point to the specific paragraphs in the arbitration award. Paragraph 19, the specific paragraphs that really discuss the unfair and deceptive conduct underlying the arbitrator's award. Paragraph 19, that Solston was denied access to books and records to which it was entitled. Paragraph 25, that the plan to transfer assets to KIC was not only planned well in advance of the actual transfer, but known to multiple Marsh Creek employees. It is unfair and it is deceptive. And in paragraph 24 of the arbitrator's award, there is a litany of unfair and deceptive conduct that the arbitrator found. That Solston was not timely advised that one of the loans had been made, that misrepresentations were made to Solston about the status of that loan, that management committee meetings were scheduled with unnecessary speed, that loans were authorized by the management committee despite obvious conflicts of interests, that a capital call was made on an artificially quick and unnecessary schedule, that misrepresentations were made to Solston about payments having been made on the loans, that Marsh Creek did not make payments on the loans despite having the ability to do so, and that the strict foreclosure agreement was unnecessary and unjustified. And we don't just have to take the arbitrator's word for it, although the arbitrator's findings after those proceedings certainly entitled to credit and deference. We can look at what Peter Scully and Robert Masulich, two of the Holland and Knight attorneys who then went to Schwabe and continued the representation of KIC in the arbitration, what these lawyers told KIC about its exposure in the arbitration. To be clear, this was not a warning at the time of the misconduct. This was an admission years later when KIC was squarely faced with the consequences of the misconduct that defendants steered it into. And there are two memos. The one I want to focus on is at KIC 174. And Mr. Scully and Mr. Masulich admit to unfair and deceptive conduct. They admit, they tell KIC that Marsh Creek Management refused to provide Solston information that it was probably entitled to receive. They discuss how Mick McKay, who was one of the Marsh Creek executives, testified that he was taking direction from KIC when he refused to give Solston information to which Solston was entitled. Mr. Scully and Mr. Masulich write that the first loan was made in September of 2017, but was not disclosed to Solston until after it was already made. That information was later presented to Solston in a way that made it look like the loan had not already happened, when in fact it had. KIC asked Solston to approve the loan in October 2017 as if the loan was about to be made, but in fact the loan had already been made over a month earlier, although the terms of the loan had not yet been established, and that there was testimony from Walter Featherly that although the loan was made in September of 2017, that how it would be recorded or characterized was not decided until October of 2017, at which time the promissory note was backdated. Mr. Scully and Mr. Masulich continue that the second loan was made on November 30th, 2017, and KIC noticed a Marsh Creek Management Committee meeting on November 29th, just one day prior, for the purpose of making a capital call, and if Solston would not agree, just to approve the loan. Similarly, the third loan was made on March 1st, 2018, and again, KIC noticed a Management Committee meeting on short notice, Solston refused a capital call, and KIC's member representative approved the loan over Solston's objection. Mr. Scully and Mr. Masulich admit to KIC that Marsh Creek never made a single payment on any of the loans, although it looks like they could have made the minimum payments required to keep the loans from going into default. And they admit that Marsh Creek Management's monthly statements reflected that the loan payments were being made when in fact they were not, so Solston was not put on notice that the loans were going into default. This is conduct that is unfair. This is conduct that was deceptive, and it was conduct that harmed KIC and caused the nearly $7 million arbitration judgment, as well as other categories of harm that I've discussed this morning. Now, we submit, as I've just discussed, that each of the categories Professor Colt discusses are attributable to unfair or deceptive conduct by the defendants. And it goes without saying, of course, if Your Honor disagrees, the court may reach different conclusions on certain of those categories. It's not an all-or-nothing proposition, but we do submit that the evidence supports the award of UTPA damages in connection with each of the categories of damages discussed in Professor Colt's report. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Mr. McGuire.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Oh, Oh, yes, we need to give you our binder, Your Honor.
Yeah, sure.
And yes.
Well.
Your Honor, would it be okay if we took a 5-minute break?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do 10.
10, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Please have a seat. All right, round two. Mr. McGuire.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. By advancing new theories, after default, KIC is attempting to turn what was pled as a $6.2 million case into an $80 million case. That's not appropriate, Your Honor. Consistent with your instruction, I'm not going to argue today whether defendants violated the UTPA. I'm addressing the narrower question that you told us to focus on. Which of Dr. Colt's damages categories are the kinds of damages that the UTPA actually troubles? Because the answer has been stricken, liability's fixed. We're not here to dispute fault today. That message has been delivered and received.
Sometimes it takes a while.
Well,
these things to stick.
Yes. Well, we're all zealous advocates. Causation for liability purposes or credibility is not on the table today, so we understand the posture. But trebling under the UTPA is not automatic, even in default. It only applies to damages that are caused by conduct that's actionable and pled as violations of the UTPA. And it's compensatory in nature, damages for a UTPA violation. They're not derivative or consequential or remedial. They have to be caused by the deceptive act. So that's the question before the court this morning, is to understand what is compensatory versus what's derivative, remedial, or consequential that goes beyond the UTPA. And just, I think there's no doubt in my mind the court has this view, but Professor Colt himself implicitly recognized that the trebling question is a legal question for the court, not for him to answer in his affidavit. It's not an economic one. At his report on page 2, he says, it is my understanding that all of these damages may be subject to trebling. That maybe has been doing a lot of work in this case, Your Honor, but it's the court that gets to decide what qualifies here and what the appropriate scope is. I mentioned this yesterday, and I'll mention it again today. Moving into a default posture doesn't expand the scope of remedies or damages. The UTPA here is not punitive. It doesn't move us from what's in the complaint into new theories that were unpled that have been introduced by affidavit. The UTPA has defined boundaries. And Mr. Hollander put up the statute, the relevant portions, which is helpful. I'll just reiterate that AS 4550531A provides that a person who suffers an ascertainable loss, so you have to have the ascertainable loss of money or property, and then here's the big section, as a result of another person's act or practice declared unlawful by the UTPA, may bring the civil action.
Where are you reading?
That's 4550531A.
Okay. Do you have that in your binder by chance?
I don't think we have the statute in the binder. We could probably pull it up on a web page. And
actually, I can get it here.
Say it again, please.
4550531A. That's certainly in the briefs. Yep.
Go ahead.
Okay. But I think that's where the issue really is controlled. It's the language of the statute. You have to have the ascertainable loss. Has to be a result of another person's practices that are declared unlawful. That's the nexus. And that's the issue really on looking through these buckets from Dr. Colt as to what, assuming even that they exist as compensatory damages, are subject to trebling. It is not the case that every loss that happened after an unfair or deceptive act is suddenly swept within the statute. It has to have that causal link. So this is a damages classification exercise. It's not a merits one. It's a category by category inquiry, not a case multiplier in the default phase. And, Your Honor, I would direct the court to ASRC Energy Service Power and Communications, the Golden Valley Electric Association, at 267 P3rd 1151, which is an Alaska Supreme Court case, where the court said, the fact that a party is a UTPA litigant in the sense that the party is asserting a UTPA claim does not transmute the party's non-UTPA claims for which the party is entitled to an award of full reasonable attorney's fees. It was focusing on the attorney's fees aspect, but the same reasoning applies to all compensatory damages. Simply because you've made a UTPA claim doesn't turn all of your other claims into a UTPA claim subject to trebling, or the damages that flow from those other claims into UTPA trebling. Your Honor, I'd offer or suggest to the court that the framework the court could approach looking at each bucket, each of these categories, involves asking a few questions as we look at each one. First, what conduct that's actually pled in the complaint caused the loss that's asserted in the category? Second, is that conduct the kind of conduct to which the UTPA applies as pled? Third, is the alleged loss compensatory, or is it a derivative remedial consequence, like consequential damages? And so again, by derivative, I mean it's not arising directly from the allegedly deceptive act, but because something else went wrong further down the line, and that those damages would not exist but for an intervening event, say like
I'll be looking for support for that position too.
It's really the language of the statute, Your Honor, and the notion of proximate cause.
Okay.
The Alaska cases don't talk a lot about how you take that next step and where you go. But if Your Honor, you know, you think about the kind of the classic type of UTPA framework is the car sale, right? You might have a dealer that advertises a car at a certain price, and you get there, and it turns out there's only one car for $20,000. And instead, they sell you the $25,000. And you say, but you advertised $20,000, and you didn't have that. The consumer can sue and say, I paid $5,000 more than what you advertised. Those are my damages. Consumer can't go to the next step of saying, gosh, I had to take out a loan to pay for the $5,000. You should pay me for the interest. My credit score dropped. I missed a mortgage payment because I had to reach for the additional payments. There's a limit to the causal line associated with the deceptive act. That's the framework. That's the common kind of UTPA fact pattern that you see. I mean, the alternative kinds of cases are the lemon law type, or the lemon cases, where you go and you buy a car that turns out to be not what it was represented. There's something wrong with it. And you return it. And you get damages associated with the fact that they told you it was something better or different than what you got. But it doesn't flow on forever to all aspects of your life. If you lost your job because the car didn't work and you didn't get to work, you don't get to go after the dealer to say, pay me my salary because I lost my job because you sold me a defective car. There are limits.
So I'm not disagreeing with you with the example that you gave, but we're in a default setting. So the court is supposed to consider proximate cause differently than if this was merits. It's different. So if you want to speak to that as well, because it seems like that guides how the court is supposed to view flow. And I mean, maybe the court is supposed to, I mean, the reasonable basis for determining damages, not being specific, because what the court's focus is trying to make a victim whole. The defaulting party is the one that, if there's a bent one way or the other, it seems like the case law suggests pretty strongly that the court has to be focused on making a victim whole. And precision is really not the word that's used, it's more reasonable basis. So if you want to make sure to include
sure.
those ideas in the, because I think the example that you gave doesn't quite get me there with how I'm supposed to view the evidence and the flow proximate cause.
Understood, Your Honor. I actually don't think the analysis changes because of the default setting on this issue, right? And the cases with respect to the default setting also say you can't turn, default doesn't turn case into a blank check. right? This,
of course.
Right?
Of course.
And they can't use affidavits to expand the scope of the allegations that were in the complaint. So we're all still rooted in the complaint. And in addition, the causation element breaks down into two parts, right? There's a causation aspect for establishing liability, and then the court is still looking at causation for purposes of damages to make sure, as the cases say, that the damages flow from the conduct that is alleged that's tied to those claims.
Sure.
And so here on the UTPA side, that's particularly important. Can't be a blank check that everything we have put in affidavits suddenly gives rise to $80 million worth of damages when we pled this as a case that's a little over $6 million. Instead, they have to show in the complaint where the allegations are that lead to the conclusion that they suffered these harms and that those harms were caused by conduct covered under the UTPA. And we don't think they've done it, Your Honor. And we think that if you spend even more time than you already have reading through the complaint, you're not going to find it either, Your Honor. And I would say if we can put up the complaint, which is tab one in our binder, paragraphs 78 is where the UTPA or do we have 78 up there? Sorry. Stephanie prepared 79 because that's what I told her, and today I said 78, so my fault. Okay, so this is the start of the section of the complaint that addresses the UTPA, right? Paragraph 78, Holland and Knight and Featherly held themselves out as legal expertise in native law and corporations law in and around Alaska. I don't think anyone believes that that's false or deceptive. Mr. Featherly has decades of experience in 8A law and native law. And Holland and Knight has a deep bench on corporations law that practiced in and around Alaska. The next one, paragraph 79. So nothing unfair or deceptive in that allegation. Paragraph 79, Holland and Knight and Featherly counseled KIC to engage in a legal strategy to wrest control and full ownership of Marsh Creek assets to KIC in a manner that breached KIC's fiduciary duties to its fellow membership owner, Solston. Okay, there's their allegation, right, that there's a strict foreclosure strategy that breached fiduciary duties. We obviously have made a lot of arguments that fiduciary duties were not breached. KIC made those arguments in the arbitration, lost, but that was their view as well, even when represented by a different law firm at Schwab. Paragraph 80. Holland and Knight and Featherly intentionally or negligently deceived KIC by directing KIC to enter into a strict foreclosure agreement with Marsh Creek for the sole purpose of wresting control, and on and on and on. So there we have the intentional or negligent. It's a little unclear. It's in the disjunctive as to what exactly is being alleged here. But again, it's the strict foreclosure agreement. Entering into the strict foreclosure agreement. Paragraph 81.
So let me ask you,
yeah.
either of those paragraphs, do you want to talk about the facts supporting those as far as the loan and trying to get the consent after the loan had been given and being deceptive about that? It seems like that goes to...
I'm happy to, if I can get to that in the context of the buckets,
sure.
I think that'll make the most sense. I think if we frame this in terms of what's in the pleading of the complaint, I hope it'll be apparent to the court that the complaint is all about the strict foreclosure.
I see.
Right?
Okay.
Because that's paragraph 81 as well. Holland and Knight and Featherly intentionally or negligently deceived KIC by directing KIC to enter into strict foreclosure agreement with Marsh Creek, again, to wrest control. Same thing, paragraph 82. To address your question about the loan, the operating agreement, the Marsh Creek operating agreement, doesn't require consent for the loan. There's a provision in the operating agreement that allows the loaning the money. I'll come back if you have more questions about that, but I don't think that could be an unfair or deceptive practice under that
circumstance. Why seek it then?
I think that's being particularly prudent and careful.
After the fact?
I don't remember the chronology of the timing of the.
Sounds like the loan was already given, and then there was a oops, and we have to get consent, and then there's this whole back and forth about how we give consent, but then let's not tell them about the loan. That's the argument.
Yeah.
If you want to point me to the record where it doesn't say that, it'd be great. But it sounds like that's what the characterization is. So.
The which one?
Cash flow, right. Yeah, obviously, the Marsh Creek was not able to make payroll and to keep the company going. They needed to loan the money before they had the consent in place and then ask for the consent after the fact.
Sure, and then there's the default and the non-payments. There, I mean, there's a lot to it.
There is a lot to it, yeah. Your Honor, yeah. But, again, those are not KIC issues. I think a lot of what you heard today are complaints by Solston about how Solston was treated. Solston's not a party to this lawsuit, although they're getting 75% of any judgment. It's important, again, to as KIC's talking about, or the lawyers are talking about these issues, to frame or to realize the court is looking at the relationship between KIC and its lawyers, not Solston and KIC's lawyers. The lawyers had a duty to zealously advocate or to represent with competence their client, which was KIC, not to represent Solston, the minority owner. And if KIC has decided the only way we can salvage these assets is to have control of the company, the lawyers are allowed to represent the majority owner in trying to do that.
Right, but in doing that, they have to make sure they understand they have a fiduciary. The KIC owes a fiduciary duty to Solston, right?
Indeed, Your Honor, and ultimately, although we disagree with the outcome of the arbitrator's decision on that point, the arbitrator's award has already addressed then the scope of the damages, which brings us back to why we all thought this was a case about the arbitration award in 6 months.
Go ahead, no.
Okay. And with respect to the expansion of the claims, and the reason why we have to go back to the complaint instead of straying into all of these affidavits that have been filed recently, Alaska law prohibits the non-defaulting party from advancing a new theory after the default order to obtain different or more extensive relief than was fairly noticed in the complaint. That's the Melendrez v. Bodie case, 941 P. 2nd, 1254, also an Alaska Supreme Court case from 1997. Where the court said Rule 54C and the holding in Oaks, referring back, were fashioned to prevent a plaintiff from seeking a default judgment different in kind or more extensive than that sought in the complaint. We cited to the Greyhound case, which is a Second Circuit case, because there's not a lot of law out there in Alaska on this, also for the proposition that the UTPA damages are limited to the injuries that are actually pled in the complaint. And again, as having walked through that complaint, paragraph, or the UTPA allegations are focused on the strict foreclosure strategy, not any reference to a loss of equity value or to some of the other categories of damages that we'll walk through.
So let me stay with that. So how would you measure damages then if in your view it's just about strict foreclosure? What are the damages related to that?
I think that takes us back to the arbitration award. And as we've argued and as our expert Paul Ficca sets forth in his affidavit, if the court looks at the arbitration award and says, okay, this is how much KIC had to pay, then the court takes the next step and says, what did KIC actually receive in value? How much does it actually take to compensate KIC for its loss in the arbitration? And we think, Mr. Ficca does all the math, we think that gets you down to zero, Your Honor, but at most it's the $1.1 million that KIC's actually paid on the arbitration award.
So you're saying the court should go inside the arbitration award and ferret out costs and damages and not just take it as a lump?
Yeah, I think the court should, if the court's purpose, as you said it is, and I totally accept, is to compensate KIC for its actual loss, I think the court has to look at what is the actual loss based on the arbitration award. And what we see is that they have a judgment against them. They paid $1.1 million of that judgment, and they got a bunch of stuff, right? They got the trucks, they got the equipment, they got the building, and they got the opportunity to make a run at creating new 8A subsidiaries. One of them, in fact, became an 8A subsidiary, qualified. Those businesses ultimately failed. Those assets were liquidated, and KIC got money for them, showing that when they took the assets, they got something. And the arbitrator basically said, now you have to pay for them. But the court, I think, needs to take that next step and say, how much did they pay? How much did they actually lose, given what they got in the process? But that, you know, fairly, Your Honor, is the strict foreclosure is pled in the complaint. That is in the UTPA allegations, although, again, in the disjunctive of intentional or negligent, making it somewhat unclear. Let me jump ahead, just in the interest of time, to the buckets, since that was the court's specific direction here. Dr. Colt, Category 1, which he broke into A and B, is the loss of Marsh Creek equity value for KIC. Right? And that's our much-discussed 2013 or 2015 Gay Part valuation numbers. We covered it yesterday. I'm not going to beat the dead horse there. But it's not eligible for treble damaging. We don't think the damages exist at all on the compensatory side or are recoverable for the reasons we argued yesterday. But it's not flowing from a UTPA violation either, because what Dr. Colt is doing is living in a but-for world in which KIC acquires Solston's 49%, right, that didn't happen, and did so in 2014 or 2015, and that Marsh Creek's enterprise value then is not only preserved but goes up eventually, right? The company recovers. Speculative, hypothetical world that didn't actually happen, and we know what actually happened through the arbitration result. Again, the complaint's UTPA allegations focus on the deceptive advice, strict foreclosure strategy, and the arbitration conduct. There's nothing that says it's a UTPA violation to have failed to close on this deal.
Do you think that's what KIC's allegation is, strictly?
I do, Your Honor.
Isn't this case really about the character of the representation that they've been receiving for years from Mr. Featherly? It's so narrow to say what you're saying, and I think it really misses what the arguments that the court has been hearing and what's been filed and what this case has been about for years. It seems like H&K, at least at some point, needs to recognize, I get it, you have your point of view, but all day long, every day, I'm reading about affidavits about how Mr. Featherly and H&K is treating KIC. I mean, we can read the same board minutes that are this long. We can see the emails that are propping up obstacles and all the nice legal terms that are used to basically say we got a big problem over here or over there. That's what is in front of the court. So please, at least at some point, observe what the court is having to navigate when I'm assessing your arguments. It's not just about failure to close. What is the reason for the failure to close? What is the reason? Dumb luck?
The price is too high. The KIC couldn't afford
it. It's the advice that's being given to KIC by Mr. Featherly. And we don't know exactly what that advice is. We know the board is relying on it. That's why my questions have been repeatedly, what advice is being given? What is the advice? They are so trusting. KIC is so trusting. They're relying on what Mr. Featherly is saying. And what is he relying on? He's not relying on the estimate of the appraisal, the certified appraiser, right? Licensed appraiser. He's not relying on that. He has an offer from Solston, who, in the court's view, is acting as a good faith JV-er, as compared to, arguably, H&K, not H&K, but Solston, KIC at the advice of H&K. So it's not helpful when I'm trying to evaluate these things to have something that's way this way and not recognizing the facts that I'm having to navigate. So it's not just about close. It's not just about a failure to close. It's not about that. I agree. It's about strict foreclosure, that's where it ends, but that's not the beginning. The beginning is, can you help us buy Solston? Can you help us buy them? And then through a series of years, and I'd like to get to the argument of, I'd like to get to an understanding of the management committee meetings. Not having, for 3 years, you have one per year. How successful is any business going to be when you're meeting once a year?
You're on, okay.
Why is it, and I know I'm rambling a little bit, but I want to give you the things that are kind of obvious, and they're right in front of us, and I need to navigate those as a court when I'm considering your opinion and I'm considering your views, but they can't ignore what's right in front of the court. Because if you do that, then it's hard for me to give it much weight if you're ignoring the facts that are in front of me. I have to interpret those things. I can't ignore them. I know you're advocating, but to be helpful, I need to know how to deal with those things that are staring me in the face. And I suppose maybe I'm giving you too much because I should just let you go and not say anything. If you're going to not talk about it, you're not going to talk about it, but I have to consider it because I have to consider the entirety of the record. So I hope I'm trying to be clear with you.
Yeah,
because I want you to address, if you can, and you don't have to. I mean, in the trial brief, the failure to close, 3 years worth of back and forths was summarized by one sentence, maybe two.
We addressed it in our affidavits, but Your Honor, it didn't feature heavily in the trial brief because it wasn't in the complaint.
Okay, so that's your position. So I'm trying to give you some of my mind so you can see how I'm looking at the facts, and I'd really like to, I'll just speechify just for two more seconds. I only get certain opportunities to hear from you all, and I'm all day long living in the affidavits. And so I'm really trying to give you an opportunity to speak to things that I have questions about. You don't have to do that at all. But I'm giving you the same opportunity that I'm giving to KIC. And that's all I'm trying to do. So please, any passion you're hearing is just trying to get to the answers if I can. That's all I'm trying to do. So
And I want to answer your questions. I mean, that is the reason that I'm here, is to attempt to address the court's concerns. So I appreciate you saying them. I will also make a record, right, with respect to the arguments that we think are correct.
Absolutely.
Here. And I'll say that this discussion, Your Honor, brings me back to the posture we're in, right, which I will admit is a new one for me. I've not experienced this before with the Rule 55, and understanding that in that posture, we really are constrained by the allegations in the complaint. And so as you're diving into the record and all of the affidavits and the exhibits, I think the court has to pause and say, should I be doing that on certain of these aspects, or should I be looking back at the complaint because we're in Rule 55 land? Because ordinarily these issues, there are different sides to these stories. A court would have witnesses and assess credibility and say, who's telling the truth here? Who's not? What was the advice here that was given? Help me understand these questions from the witnesses, you know, not from 8,000 pages of record affidavits that were dumped on you and Palmer, right? and hours of argument from the lawyers. So it does come back to what's actually in the complaint, and that is the critical document to determine the scope of the allowed damages here and which facts have actually been established by the well-pleaded allegations in the complaint. And as we talk about trebling and the UTPA, that's particularly important because we're looking, their expert has said, here are our damages. And now we go back to the complaint and we say, which of those are subject to the allegations made in the complaint that deal with the UTPA? And there just isn't anything about the, we want to buy the company and get advice from you and you failed to close. That, and nor could that be an unfair or deceptive practice. Lawyers can't guarantee that a deal is going to close or that a buyer and seller will reach an agreement that will allow a deal to go forward. And, Your Honor, on the question of the management committee, I'm going to answer the question. I feel like I'm getting a little off course from the buckets you asked us to address, but your questions are more important for sure. You're asking, you know, about meetings, or the lack of meetings, and why didn't they occur, and how that affects the business operations. So just to be clear what we have here, right, Marsh Creek was a business with its own executive team that ran the company, right? McKay, for example, John Ely later, they ran the company. They make decisions on what to do with the company. The owners aren't involved in the day-to-day operations, and as Mr. Hollander acknowledged today, and as the operating agreement indicates, Solston, as a minority member, does not have a role in running the company or managing
What's
the company.
What's their purpose as a JVer then?
They're there because the benefit of the 8A, right? Solston itself can't get the federal preferences because it's not a native corporation. It's not a minority-owned business. So it needs to hook up with KIC to be able to share in the benefits. And on the timeline that we put up yesterday, you saw the initial investments of the companies, and it was $98,000 for Solston. And the business went well for a long time, and they made many millions of dollars based on that $98,000 investment. And those are millions they couldn't have gone out and made on their own. They needed a partner in the 8A context. And I'll point the court back to the arbitration award, because these are arguments that Solston made in the arbitration. And KIC disagreed with those arguments. KIC was not represented by Holland & Knight in the arbitration. That was Schwabe at this point. Exhibit 199, which is not in our binder because this just popped up this morning in your questions, but is in the record.
Is it? So it's H&K?
H&K, yep.
199.
On page 7 is KIC's pre-hearing brief from the arbitration, and it talks about the bad relationship that KIC had with Solston. And there was the view held by the KIC team that Solston wanted to push out the Marsh Creek management. KIC liked the Marsh Creek management. So these meetings were not pleasant for KIC, and they served little purpose in terms of the actual management of the company. I can also direct you, Your Honor, to H&K Exhibit 40, which talks about Solston's efforts to take control of Marsh Creek. Solston was looking at the same kinds of issues of our venture is going to fail. How do we get money out of this? And they're exploring the same kinds of tactics to take control of the company or its assets and put pressure on Marsh Creek through pooling support for its line of credit, for example.
What's the time frame on the Solston's efforts?
2015, I believe, is Exhibit 40. So it started in November 2015, and the line of credit went away in January 2016.
Okay. So if I was looking for, a reason why Featherly is not wanting Solston, is not warm and fuzzy about Solston being a part, it sounds like this is a little late. This is November of 2015. When did Featherly begin his representation?
Well, Holland & Knight, he joined Holland & Knight in 2014.
And the letter's from, is it from June of 2014?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so a year and a half almost. Okay.
Sure. I mean, obviously it didn't all magically happen on November 2015.
Sure, sure.
Issues were building.
Just trying to piece together dynamics and relationships and things. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to your point, I trying to get a sense of things, especially when I'm being asked that, you know, to value a company over a period of time, what's the activity and what's the advice? I mean, it takes a lot to kind of take it all in. So,
right, Your Honor, and I mean, having a bunch of witnesses come in and tell the story would be the most effective way to do that. I know we're not going to get to do that, so I'm doing the best I can to try and answer the court's questions. I mean, I'll also direct you to KIC's 30B6 testimony in this deposition. Mr. Lampe, page 155, and the court knows this too, but a 30B6 witness, his testimony is the company's testimony. It's binding on the company. And he testified that his predecessor for KIC, Mr. Tiklik, felt that Solston was too aggressive. The relationships were dysfunctional between Solston and KIC. The KIC leadership itself didn't want to meet with Solston, didn't want to spend time with them. Their lawyer was doing what he's supposed to do to protect them and advocate for their interests. If the Marsh Creek executives who actually run the company thought that it would be helpful in the day-to-day running of the company to have more management committee meetings, they could always ask for them. It's up to them. This management committee issue is a red herring.
It seems like it's needed at certain points. I mean, just
once a year. We have an annual partnership partnership meeting at the firm once a year.
Sure.
Right. Other people run the business, and if they need more direction, they can ask for it.
Yeah, I guess the tenor of some of the exchanges, especially from Ms. Kale on behalf of Ms. Solston, is that there's a business aspect that everyone needs to be paying attention to that's not really being addressed, or at least Solston's not being heard on those issues.
Well, it's a good thing Mr. Featherly didn't represent Solston, Your Honor, right? His duty was to KIC, which had a very different view of the facts and the relationships than the Solston lawyer.
As to the business, what are you saying?
As to Marsh Creek.
Right, so they're losing money for three consecutive years. Where is that being addressed? Shouldn't that at least be addressed or talked about at the manager's meeting? How it's being addressed? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me that the approach is to, if it's an annual meeting, just to strong arm or to kind of keep a JV partner at arm's length and limit access and limit information. I mean, it's not following for me.
Yeah, that's right. I think maybe the easiest thing, Your Honor, that is normal business operations between a majority and minority owner and reflects the different interests and rights. But the arbitrator went through all of these arguments. These were the same arguments that Solston made in the arbitration that KIC said wasn't true, that they're now saying is true. And the arbitrator made findings about this, which is at tab 14 of our binder.
What page?
It's page 21 of the arbitration award. So tab 14, that's H&K Exhibit 201. And it starts paragraph 40. And it continues for quite a ways. Stephanie, do you have that?
43 is key.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to walk through all of them if we can just pull them up.
No, and I'm familiar with the arbitrator's award. So if you just give me the references, I can refresh.
I mean, paragraph, sorry, Your Honor.
I can refresh later. I've looked at this many, many times. So.
Let me just highlight for you again, paragraph 40. Solston's claim of being denied a role in management is misplaced, right? The walks through the operating agreement.
Right, I'm not suggesting that they have a role in management. It just seems like access to information. It seems like if someone's a JV, they should have access to what are we doing, why are we doing it. I know I have no say or I have minimal say, but you might want to think about my view of things.
You might.
Seems like, or not.
But the law doesn't require it.
Sure, but if you have a fiduciary to that, you have to at least explain why you're being a fiduciary and you have, you're making good decisions. And I get it, this business, and I have minimal experience with that, but it seems like you still want to have an involved partner. If it's just for 8A purposes, I get that too, but it does seem like there's a obligation to inform and advise what we're doing, especially when, as has been said numerous times, the business is failing. I think that's H&K's view, is that it's failing 15, 16, and 17 years, 15, 16, and 17. What are they doing to address that?
And Your Honor, it's just not the law. I understand you might think
What's not the law?
That the majority owner needs to provide all of this additional information and access and engage with the minority owner in that way.
Tell me what would be minimally complying with fiduciary duties, a KIC to Solston, when the business is failing. What would be the minimal responsibilities?
Honestly, that's too broad of a hypothetical for me to fairly answer.
It's not a hypothetical. It's what's happening in
this case. Yeah, it's too broad of a question for me to fairly answer, but they have statutory obligations, right, with respect to access to books and records, which is a term of art in the statute as to the information they're provided. Mm-hmm. They have to have the annual meeting, right? They have to take actions in a way that's consistent with not oppressing the minority owner's rights, right? But these, again, Your Honor, are things that were argued aggressively on both sides in the arbitration, where KIC took a very different position than what it's taking today. And the arbitrator, as you continue in those paragraphs, I would go all the way from paragraph 40 to paragraph 44 it's 43 in the arbitrator's award to look at this. The arbitrator heard all of those arguments, I'm sure received the legal arguments as well as to what the obligations were on the fiduciary duty, because that's what the case was about, and said Solston's exclusion from management does not justify using the Gay Park valuation from 2015. The date of the injury is the date of the strict foreclosure in 2018, right? Paragraph 43, nor is evaluation date of March 31, 2015 otherwise justifiable. Unlike the facts in the Delaney case, there's little evidence that KIC would receive a windfall if a later valuation was used for evaluation purposes. And he walks through, distinguishes cases, and says the evidence and the law do not justify using a March 31, 2015 date for purposes of determining damages. You couldn't reach back to this previous time and say, here's what would have happened in this hypothetical world. We have to look at what actually happened and what the company was worth in 2018. And that's where the arbitrator came out, when the strict foreclosure was executed upon.
The valuation that the arbitrator did, though, was more assets, right? Didn't do a enterprise value.
He did not, and Mr. Ficca's report explains why you don't do both. They're alternative measures, right? You're valuing the same thing two different ways, they already had the assets. KIC got the assets through the strict foreclosure, and now, right? Because that essentially, KIC said we're taking the whole company, right?
Sure.
And we're going to take it all. We're going to spin it off into subs. We're going to try and qualify the subs as 8A and make a go of the failing businesses. Until the end of the arbitration, they were able to use those assets without having paid for them, basically, right? They owned 51% of them, but they hadn't paid for Solston's 49% until the arbitrator said, look, you took the assets, you have to pay for them, and here's how much Solston's interest is worth in the company. You have to pay them now that you've taken all these assets.
Right? Can you differentiate the asset value from the enterprise value? You said they're two different measures, but they're different. Isn't the enterprise value assets, but it's also assets employed, how well-sourced the company is, it's got employees, it's got a track record for business, it's got these opportunities lined up, it has these current contracts. Isn't there more of a market value aspect to, meaning what can it do?
Yeah.
So it's not the same. What I was trying to ask,
yeah,
and maybe I didn't ask it right, but it's not the same. They're both different measures, got that, but they're not the same measure, right?
Right. I mean, you would typically, I have to be careful because I'm not a valuation expert, so I don't want to mislead you, but in the business valuation cases I've handled, you typically see the enterprise value it's not usually called that, but enterprise value as something for a going concern company, right? That's going to continue where you can, where experts argue about how successful it's going to be and what the future revenue will likely be. And you tend to see measuring of the assets in liquidation, right, where companies are either failing or shutting down or transferring all their assets to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So two different forecasting models, or one's a forecasting model, speculating, and the other is a here are the assets we actually have.
Sure.
And when you look at the arbitrator did consider this kind of issue and said, as a going concern value, Marsh Creek's value is zero, right? And sure. looked instead at the assets. Right? And we know what the assets were, and we know what the value of the assets were based on the arbitrator's decision. What we have now is KIC trying to, through the back door of the default proceedings and affidavits, go back to this hypothetical world that doesn't exist of when Marsh Creek was a going concern and successful at its best, mm-hmm. and articulate a theory to try and say, never mind that we got the assets later and we know how much they are. What if all of these cards had fallen into place back in 2013, 14, 15, 16, and we had acquired the company and gotten 8A certification and gotten federal contracts and been wildly successful? That's what we should be paid for. And that's highly speculative, and it's an inconsistent theory from the arbitration award saying, here's the value of the company and the assets that you took.
Sure.
I don't think I've gotten through any buckets, Your Honor.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Perhaps we've beaten it to death on the enterprise value, because that's the 1A, 1B. We don't think those damages exist, and we don't think they can flow from any UTPA violations that were alleged in the complaint. They just aren't tied there. It's a pure expectancy, transactional malpractice kind of damages claim that assumes a transaction that never occurred. It's not consumer deception. That's not the issue here. Category two, the loss of KIC's cash contributions, which is the $2.86 million. Again, we do not believe that those are subject to trebling. They're internal transfers between entities that are controlled by KIC, capital infusions to them. And the record shows in Colt's report, section 2, page 4, he says three of these cash transfers, all of which were authorized or ratified by board resolution. So the record shows the KIC board approved all of those. They're also derivative of the business failure, not because of consumer deception. They're an effort at consequential damages. And there's no misrepresentation in the record that's tied to the act of transferring the funds. Colt characterized these as throwing good money after bad in the excerpt that's up on the screen. Good money after bad strongly suggests we're past the causal link of the deceptive practice, and that's not a UTPA category. Category three, you take that one down just a second. The additional loss of net proceeds from the sale of the building. Again, the proceeds here either went to KIC or KIC's wholly owned subsidiary. That's not an ascertainable loss, which was the language back in the statute, or actual damages under the UTPA. Paul Ficka's affidavit at paragraph 60 explains this in detail. In the interest of time, I will not go through it here. These are liquidation proceeds, partially paid to KIC, partially retained by Kaktovik Holdings. Trebling liquidation proceeds would multiply the realized value, not compensate for a loss caused by deception.
Say that last sentence again.
The trebling the liquidation proceeds, which were partially paid back to KIC, and partially retained by Tectovic Holdings would, it would multiply the realized value that they got from the liquidation. Mm-hmm. It's not compensating them for a loss associated with deceptive practices. In category four, the attorney's fees paid to Holland and Knight. We acknowledge this is the only category that plausibly could fit under the UTPA. It's different because defendants plaintiffs allege that the defendants misrepresented their expertise, induced retention, and billed under purportedly deceptive premises. And that's in their UTPA section of the complaint, 78 through 81. That aligns with what plaintiff calls the entrepreneurial aspect of legal services. Okay, but the limits, I think Mr. Hollander appropriately acknowledged, apply only to fees that were actually paid, not unpaid balances. And Dr. Colt, in his analysis, have both. And it should only be fees that are caused by the unfair or deceptive practices, not all work that the law firm did over a six-year period, not post-disclosure work, and not work that's unrelated to the corporate aspects. Our experts, again, walk through that analysis. Mr. Lee goes through, and we've included, I think, in our trial brief as well, the analysis and the charts showing the reductions there. But big picture, only the fees that actually were paid that flow from the allegations that were pled in paragraph 78 through 81 should be subject to potential trebling. From our view, that works out to be $317,793. We also believe that the fees paid to Holland and Knight by Tectovic Holdings, which were $206,911, are not within the scope of damages that can be recovered here, because they were paid by Holdings, not by KIC, nor were they solely related to the UTPA conduct at issue here of the strict foreclosure. Tectovic Holdings was a separate client, separate engagement letter, separate billing arrangement. Category five, Schwabe's attorney's fees of $149,000. Those are not eligible for trebling. Again, the plaintiff's theory here is that the injury occurred when defendant's advice allegedly caused collapse, foreclosure, and arbitration exposure. That was all before Schwabe was retained. So these are paid to successor counsel long after the alleged deceptive conduct, and they're really remedial litigation expenses concerning the arbitration defense. Nothing in Dr. Colt's analysis indicates those fees were induced by deceptive practices or deceptive advertising or even paid to the alleged deceiver in this context. So trebling them would not treble deception cost harm. It only addresses dealing with the harm after it occurred, and that is a distinction that this plain language of the statute reinforces cannot allow recovery. Jump ahead to category six, the consulting fees paid to Strutz, to RCS Consulting, $556,000. These are wind-down costs. They're management liquidation services. Most of it is interest due to non-payment, according to Dr. Colt in his report in Section 6. These are kind of classic consequential-type damages, remedial damages, not damages from directly from deceptive practices. And there's nothing in the complaint that alleges they were induced by deception. The complaint, paragraphs 55 through 61, cover the RCS consulting matters. And just to be clear, they only paid, KIC's only paid $160,000 of that on an initial balance of $356,000. By failing to timely pay, the interest is now over $200,000, which certainly is at the very least a failure to mitigate on damages here, and that would be an independent basis to exclude it.
Can you argue failure to mitigate?
I just did, Your Honor. I believe so.
Can I consider failure to mitigate?
I think if Your Honor is considering the affidavits and the 8,000 pages of record and the legal arguments we're making, that you should also be considering what actually compensates for loss here. What is the compensatory damages? And it can't be that the plaintiff can fail to take actions and drive up their own costs and expenses and say, now compensate me for something that was solely within my control.
Yeah, I hear the argument. I'm just saying, can I consider it?
I think you can, Your Honor. I think you should.
As a defaulting party, can I consider it?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
New posture for me, though. So, we've talked about the arbitration judgment, which is Category 7. It's a judicially imposed obligation to a third party. If the court were to treble that, you're multiplying an arbitration award. You're multiplying a judgment that exists. That would convert compensating for a loss into a penalty, and it's really stretched the UTPA beyond its statutory role. The arbitration award is a measure of the consequences of a fiduciary breach. It's not damages caused by deceptive inducement. They don't compensate Solston's injury, and they don't measure KIC's reliance on deceptive practices.
Is it any different than the case that I have? I mean, it seems like the party there is KIC. They're the bad actor in the arbitration award judgment. Here, the bad actor allegedly is H&K and Mr. Featherly. So it seems like the link is, to the extent that the arbitrator found KIC as the bad actor, what I'm being asked today is, well, really, KIC did what they did because H&K and Featherly are the bad actor. So is it unrelated, or it seems like it's related? You said it wasn't based on deceptive practices.
Right. It wasn't based on deceptive practices. It was a breach of fiduciary duty finding, right? It wasn't that KIC had done something.
That is, but as far as the facts that I have.
You are dealing with a different set of allegations, although, again, constrained by what's in the complaint.
Right, but I mean, as far as the arbitration award went, was why did KIC do, or what did KIC do?
Right.
And so the case that I have is, here's the reason why KIC did what they did, and it's H&K and it's Mr. Featherly. So it seems like the unfair trade gets to the judgment. At least there's a link there. Unless there's some other reason KIC did in the arbitration award did what they did. Seems like it's the same, but.
Well, Your Honor, I think there are a lot of reasons why KIC did what it did.
I'm repeating the argument, the link,
yeah,
for why it.
Fair. I'm probably repeating the same answers back that are unsatisfactory to you, Your Honor. But there, we've talked about a laundry list of issues, right, between the parties, between KIC and Solston, a macroeconomic issue with Marsh Creek, catastrophic change with ICO Bay. We've talked about the decline in oil prices. We've talked about the 8A expiring. There's a lot of factors that go into any harm that KIC has suffered that have nothing to do with Holland and Knight. But the complaint and what KIC has been seeking is to say everything is Holland and Knight. And that goes too far.
Right. I'm just responding to the arbitration award that you were saying wasn't related to unfair business practices, and it seems like it is.
Giving a client advice.
Not there, but here it is.
Giving a client advice as to how to proceed that a court ultimately says doesn't accept doesn't turn it into an unfair and deceptive practice, Your Honor. I'm not going to argue about the learned professions exemption, but that's why it exists, right? Is that you chill the profession if when you have a client that's in dire straits and has very no good options available to it, the lawyer has to say, I can't give you any options because there's too much risk. And as we know here, the advice that was given included, and you see it in Sarah Curtis's notes, that there's a litigation risk, right? And that KIC ultimately decided to take that risk and proceeded with the arbitration after Holland and Knight was out. And Schwabe made the decision to drop the counterclaim in the case that KIC had, which could have had a material change in the outcome of that arbitration to address Solston's failures as a minority member and the Ico Bay disasters as well. Those were things outside of Holland and Knight's ability to control that we believe contributed to the outcome in the arbitration award that are intervening causes that cut off any causal link at all here. Right. Mr. Gilmore helpfully points out, you know, if, to the extent the court's looking for a remedy, there are these other claims in the case, right? There's the malpractice claim. That's the place to go. It's not converting a malpractice claim into an Unfair Trade Practices Act claim and expanding the scope of what was pled in the complaint. Your Honor, I could probably go on for an hour. I know I don't have that, and I don't want to test your patience.
I think we could all go on for a long time on this case. There are some cases that lend themselves to that, and this is one of them. So.
Indeed. The case does involve serious allegations, but the fact that they're serious allegations doesn't expand statutes.
Sure.
The court can and should respect the default process that we're in and the constraints on what the court should be considering, focusing on the complaint. It can enforce the UTPA, and it can avoid, at the same time, a legally unsupported windfall to KIC by giving them this blank check. Trebling should be limited to the narrow category that actually fits the statute, with a ruling that is faithful to the pleadings, faithful to cold zone analysis, and faithful to Alaska law, as cited by both sides. It sounds like we'll have an opportunity later today for rebuttal, Your Honor. There are certainly some things I'd like to say about Von Bergen that came up today and about the Ico Bay issues that came up today and the letters, but that came up in the Mr. Hollander's arguments. Assuming we have time this afternoon rather than cutting into rebuttal here.
I wasn't going to have any extra.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it was just going to be Mr. Slarsky responding to you from yesterday about double damages. There was just going to be some time for that.
Can I respond later today to some of the things he raised yesterday?
On which part?
Well, he's...
I felt like server bill. I mean, the usual volley is motion, op, reply, and that's how, kind of the format I was following.
Yeah.
For arguing.
Sure, Your Honor. I mean, this wasn't a motion. This was you guys focused on...
It's the process that I... It's the process I was following, like a motion, so...
Yeah.
I mean, what did you want to address?
I'd like to talk about the... They keep talking about Mr. Featherly made misrepresentations about Solston's ability to continue on Ico Bay. And I think that's wrong. And
sure, the letter I mentioned yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, no, I'd like to hear about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And similarly, this notion of a bait and switch with Von Bergen, the lawyer, the M&A lawyer, is wildly off base and inconsistent with the time records, and also inconsistent with what Mr. Von Bergen would say if he testified as to his role and the role of an M&A lawyer. He was involved. He would testify that he was heavily involved given where the process was, and that an M&A lawyer is not needed at the point where you're negotiating, you're just sending the term sheets back and forth. You have to get closer to an actual deal for the M&A lawyer to really have the expertise that or for the expertise of an M&A lawyer to really apply.
Sure, and that was the question I asked Mr. Slarsky. So if you want to address that, that's fine. Those two points, that's fine.
Okay, do that this afternoon?
Yeah, I want to get to Mr. Slarsky, actually, for you wanted time. I know we'd have to do a rebuttal, but we wanted to do time, 20 minutes for...
I had a couple points from yesterday.
Sure. I guess what I would do is just say 20 to 30 minutes for those
fine.
Different topics that you want to talk about.
Yeah. Great. Thank
you. Let's do rebuttal, and then we'll try to fit in Mr. Slarsky, and then this afternoon after we're done with rebuttal, we'll fit your time in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yep.
I don't want to spend any meaningful time on arguments that this court has already addressed numerous times about new theories being raised now or
you know, what was pleaded in the complaint with regard to enterprise damages.
But we don't see the term, right?
That is fair.
So that's been a source of a lot of filings and a lot of argument.
Correct. With regard to the UTPA claim first, of course, the count itself restates the prior allegations in the body of the complaint. And then the very next paragraph, paragraph 77, is that Holland and Knight and Featherly engage in unfair and deceptive conduct in its dealings with, in their dealings with KIC. And that does fairly encompass much of what we've been discussing today, but I will also point to specific allegations in the complaint regarding especially this 2014 to 2017 time period. They begin around paragraph 24. If you look at paragraph 25, it discusses the advice by Holland and Knight attorneys to limit Sulston's access to Marsh Creek's books and records that was intended to impair Sulston's interest in an understanding of the Marsh Creek investment with the objective of making Sulston more willing to sell at an unfairly low price. If that is not an allegation of unfair conduct, I'm not sure what is. It says right there, at an unfairly low price, and goes on. If you look at paragraph 29, between 2014 and 2017, among other things, Holland and Knight and Featherly advised and directed KIC to improperly refuse Sulston access to Marsh Creek's books and records, meaningfully engage in decisions about Marsh Creek's operations, or meaningfully discuss Marsh Creek's finances. I would submit that that also covers the time period that we are talking about and unfair or deceptive conduct. I want to say also the statute is, again, in the disjunctive, unfair or deceptive. Mr. McGuire at times suggested that the standard is false or deceptive. It's not. It's unfair. And it's not unfair and deceptive, it's unfair or deceptive. So it is not just, for instance, deceptive inducement, which was something that Mr. McGuire suggested. We laid out, and I discussed earlier, and it's in our brief, a bevy of unfair or deceptive conduct at times that did amount to affirmative misrepresentations. At times it amounted to unfair conduct designed to put a thumb on the scale improperly in KIC's dealings with Sulston or otherwise to manipulate outcomes in an improper manner. I also just want to briefly address, you know, Mr. McGuire stood up here and he said, we hear you, Your Honor. We're not here to dispute liability. And we then heard a number of factual disputes regarding proximate cause, factual disputes about the arbitration outcome and the conduct underlying the arbitration outcome. Those are disputes to liability. Those are not proper here. Now, there
some of it was from my questions. Some of the discussion is from my questions.
That's
but
fair.
But I hear what you're saying.
Now, regarding the arbitration award, I don't believe our argument is that, you know, either that everything bad that has ever happened in the history of the world is due to Holland and Knight, or that the arbitration award was solely the result of bad lawyering. It was the result of bad lawyering. It was also the result of malpractice, but it was also the result of unfair or deceptive practices. And as we discussed this morning, the arbitration was initiated on based on incomplete and unreliable information that Holland and Knight provided to KIC. Many of the key facts that exposed KIC to liability in the arbitration included unfair and deceptive conduct that Holland and Knight engaged in and directed towards Sulston with regard to the strict foreclosure scheme. So saying that, you know, just because there's an arbitration award doesn't make it a UTPA, a basis for UTPA damages, that's correct. The specific facts here, which are alleged in the complaint, which are supported by ample evidence, are what make it subject to trebling under the UTPA. I also want to address Mr. McGuire's assertion that consequential damages are not permitted under the UTPA, and that's simply not correct. If you look at the Kenai Chrysler case, Mr. McGuire discussed a situation where there is a UTPA violation in connection with the sale of a car, and that you don't get consequential damages based on the downstream consequences of that. Kenai Chrysler deals exactly with that. And the cost of obtaining a substitute for a car after the plaintiff lost the use of his car due to unfair and deceptive trade practices. The question is, what is an ascertainable loss? And as we know from the portfolio recovery case, that may even include the cost of paying for parking to go and see your lawyer when he is giving you unfair or deceptive advice or steering you into an unfair or deceptive course of conduct. Now, I'll also address the argument that KIC, I believe Mr. McGuire's words were, got stuff in the strict foreclosure, and that stuff included, for instance, 8A opportunities. Well, we know that those 8A opportunities themselves were illusory and doomed as a result of they were fruit of the poisonous tree. They were doomed by the misconduct that Holland and Knight steered, which included, again, ample instances of unfair or deceptive misconduct. Mr. McGuire also suggested that, lawyers cannot guarantee a deal will get done. M&A lawyers are not guarantors of a deal getting done. In certain instances, that may be true, but what lawyers can guarantee, if they act improperly and unfairly and deceptively and manipulate information and manipulate the process, is that a deal won't get done, which is what happened here. The question isn't, are they liable under the UTPA simply because the deal didn't close? It's, are they liable under the UTPA because they unfairly and or deceptively caused the deal not to get done?
So on that point, Mr. McGuire is saying, what I hear him saying is that, well, okay, he's not saying that that's the case, but to the extent he's saying, KIC is arguing that's the case, why would the court award enterprise value for a deal that doesn't get done? There's no guarantee. And are you doing that? Because I always understood it as it was just one of the many things that was kind of in the line of what costs the business.
Yes, you understood that correctly. And as we discussed this morning, there was unfair and deceptive conduct that, infected the relationship with Sulston, prevented Sulston from providing input, and in large part caused much of the decline in revenues and value after the deal couldn't get done. So, by 2014 or maybe 2016, the deal was dead. Sulston, based on false, based on unfair, and based on deceptive conduct by the defendants, was shut out of discussions, shut out of any real role. They may have been a minority partner. They were not a silent partner, and there is an important difference there. If KIC did not want Marsh Creek or did not want Sulston to have at least a seat at the table at the Marsh Creek Management Committee meetings, there were options available under the operating agreement. Those options would ultimately have required a payment to Sulston at fair market value for its 49%. That didn't happen because KIC didn't want to pay fair market value. And what happened instead was they unfairly and deceptively froze Sulston out of information, out of meetings, out of access to management, all the while the value of Marsh Creek was continuing to decline. I also want to say that that is not speculative. When we look at the Gabehart valuation, when we look at the discussion of the productive and valuable relationship between KIC and Sulston, and when we look at the valuation that expressly is acknowledging the graduation from the 8A program and based instead on the opportunities available to Marsh Creek post-8A contracting work that's available and otherwise, that is what that valuation number is based on. And it's not speculation. It is a licensed independent or, you know, a licensed appraisal that was conservative in measure given the circumstances under which it came up. And I'm sorry, I think I misspoke. I said that KIC didn't want to pay fair market value. KIC was instructed by its attorneys, was you know, essentially manipulated by its attorneys unfairly and deceptively away from negotiating a deal that would have been for fair market value. That's what the record shows. We've discussed that extensively yesterday and today. Unless Your Honor has any further questions, that's all I have on rebuttal. Mr. Slarsky, when he addresses the court later, will also address one or two of the arguments that Mr. McGuire made yesterday as well as today that are, you know, wrapped up in the question of Sulston and its conduct towards Marsh Creek.
Sure. So thank you to both of you. So let's do this. It's straight up noon. So why don't we take a break for an hour, and then we'll plan on doing a reset for argument on punitive damages, and then we'll save a half an hour for each of you after those arguments are done to talk about those things. I'm going to limit. Here's what I'll do. I'll limit your time. You can talk about what you want to talk about. That's the way I'll control the presentation. So because I know it's not a same. You want to talk about different things. So.
Just one housekeeping issue, which is we provided an additional exhibit to defendants last night, which I'd like to offer up to the court if that's that's okay. It's a compilation of the Von Bergen time records that you had asked about yesterday.
Great, thank you. Should I wait to hear? I know it's not your filing. I'll take a look at it first, and then we can hear on it.
Your Honor, we also have a printout of the timeline from yesterday. Where we did correct the dates.
Yeah, you want to hand it up? Cooperation, love it. All right, we'll be in recess till 1:00.